This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's only so much stuff in the world. There's only so much lithium. There's only so much copper. And we've got to start setting limits so that the 1% and the 0.1% don't eat everything up. We've got to leave stuff for the rest of the world.
It seems fitting this week, as millions of Americans sit down to an enormous feast, that we discuss the topic of overindulgence. And we're not just talking about turkey and pie. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Canadian environmental journalist Lloyd Alter about sufficiency. We discuss the need to develop sufficiency measures in the sustainability space, talk about examples of sufficiency from the corporate world, and look at Paul Brannan's recent book Timber, which makes the case that wood is a more sustainable building material as compared to mined or manufactured compounds. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by environmental journalist Lloyd Alter. Lloyd, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Fun to be here again.
So we've spoken many times over the years, and you've done a lot of important work for various outlets. Now you're running your own site through a Substack called Carbon Upfront, which we will link to on Sea Change Radio. And it's a terrific new resource. I highly recommend our listeners check it out. Why don't we first use this piece that you wrote on November 20th about sufficiency as a springboard for a larger discussion. It's entitled, A New Report Explains Why We Must Put Sufficiency First. Why don't you give us an executive summary of that report to kick things off?
For years, everybody in the environmental industry, everyone everywhere is talking about efficiency. Efficiency is so important that we have to be more efficient about everything. And more recently, you heard more people talking about we have to use renewables rather than fossil fuels. And the two things everybody was talking about was efficiency and renewables. But the trouble with efficiency measures is that as things get more efficient, we tend to make up the difference by using more of them. So as cars got more efficient, they got bigger. As houses got more efficient, we made them bigger. As fridges got more efficient, we got bigger fridges because it didn't cost any more to run them. And so all of the and most of the energy savings would get eaten up by the increased use of bigger products.
Almost like widening a highway. And then instead of just having a nice, efficient 3-lane highway, we built 6 lanes. And what do you get? Voila, more traffic.
More traffic. And the problem with this, a lot of people, this has been called the rebound effect, and it's been called Jevons paradox after Stanley Jevons, the British economist who first noticed it with steam engines, that as steam engines got more efficient, we didn't use less coal, we used more coal. And everybody says, well, people don't buy bigger fridges or they don't drive twice as far because their car is more efficient, but they save money and they often spend that money on something else. So the case has been made that all gains in efficiency get eaten up. What sufficiency is the third leg of that triangle between efficiency, using renewables. What we also have to do is start just deciding how much do we really need? How much space do we need? How big a car do we need? All of these things, we have to look at what are the limits so that there is enough stuff for everyone. And an Australian philosopher, Samuel Alexander, put it that efficiency without sufficiency is lost. That basically, if we don't think sufficiency, then all of our efficiency gains are going to be lost. And you just see that in our our fossil fuel consumption, that basically, yes, things are much more efficient than they were just 5 years ago, but we're still burning more fossil fuels. We're getting more cars. You look at the electric cars that came out, and what did they start with? They started with sort of big Teslas and now Rivians and Hummer, electric Hummers, with giant, giant batteries, instead of saying, how much do we really need? What is enough to get from A to B? Do we need a big electric car? Do we need an electric car at all? Or can you be like me and use an electric bike? Because when you live in a city, it's sufficient. In the spring, I went to a conference in Paris and spoke about sufficiency. And it became part of a document so that in a lot of places now, it's going to become part of the Paris Agreement that we also have to start thinking about sufficiency. And that's why I wrote this week, because this document was presented in Azerbaijan, where everything is just going down into the shredder and the memory hole as it's released. But nonetheless, it was presented that we have to start thinking about how much do we really need. We have to start thinking about sufficiency. It's now on the menu. It's now in the minutes. I hope that it becomes important, because without it, we just keep burning more stuff.
Well, I would think that one of the best ways of it gaining importance is to be able to transition to measuring sufficiency, like we've been trying to measure efficiency. Where are some of the challenges, and where are some of the lower hanging fruit in transitioning metrics from efficiency to sufficiency, Lloyd?
Well, one of the things that we always do with our building codes and with everything we do with our fuel efficiency is we talk about, you know, so many watts per square foot, or so much per this, per that. And so things can get bigger, and as long as they're efficient, everybody thinks it's great. What a lot of people, and particularly the Europeans who are leading in sufficiency in France, are saying, what we now have to start talking about is so much energy per person. So you get in your San Francisco, when you go for a building permit, it's no longer going to be under a sufficiency regime. You would no longer get, you can only burn so much energy per square foot. What it's going to be is that you, Alex, you get to have so many watts, period. That this is all your allowance, your ration is. So if you want to live in a house that's like 5,000 square feet, you're going to have to make the walls like 2 feet thick full of insulation, because you're only allowed so much carbon emissions for you. We figured out what is sufficient and what the world can support. And everybody who wants more is going to have to spend more, basically, to keep under that limit. So there's going to be limits set for cars. You know, how much electricity is it necessary for you to use? You know, you don't need the Rivian for that, unless you're using it for work or something like that, or you can justify it, and you're going to have to pay for it, because people are going to look at, you know, how much is necessary. And a lot of people just, you know, my readers just say, that's communism. You know, you're telling us, you're rationing everything. And ultimately, that's what we're going to have to do, because there's only so much stuff in the world. There's only so much lithium. There's only so much copper. And we've got to start setting limits so that the 1% and the 0.1% don't eat everything up. We've got to leave stuff for the rest of the world.
So you're saying that we can still apply the same carbon footprint metrics, but then take it to another level and apply them differently on a person-by-person basis, and saying you're limited to this carbon footprint. So that's adding that sufficiency element to what we've already kind of figured out efficiency-wise in terms of carbon footprint. Is that correct?
Yes. So you're, you know, we figure what is enough to live a comfortable life. And it might be the upper side of the average. And if you want more than that, then there's going to have to be a structure where you pay for that. And there, you know, you have to buy rights for it, or someone I might say, I'm only living in 800 square feet, I'll sell you the 250 square feet that I'm not using, I'll sell you credits of it. There's going to someday be a sort of market in this kind of thing, so that there's enough for everyone, instead of it all being hogged by the rich.
So could you give us an example of this efficiency model on a corporate or government scale, not just in an individual one?
Well, let's look at Apple. Apple just introduced on October 24th the new Mac Mini. And Apple, over the years, has done an incredible job of designing carbon out of their computers in two ways. They've made them way smaller. The new Mac Mini is half the size of the Mac Mini from 2015. And they've gone more for recycled materials and everything. And they cut their carbon footprint down from 174 kilograms for the Mac Mini to just 32. Like, this is a massive, massive reduction. Now, other companies might not be doing anything, but you know, they're sort of, at some point, governments might say, well, if Mac can get their computers down to 32 kilograms of carbon for a fabulous top-of-the-line computer, what's an average that everybody should be hitting for? What is enough carbon to build a computer? Apple said 32 kilograms. Dell, what do you think is a reasonable number? At some point, people are going to ask, what is enough carbon to build something like that computer? And corporations will probably be sort of pay a carbon tax for the difference if they don't get there. Just like a lot of Europe and in Canada, there's now a carbon tax on CO2 emissions. There might be a carbon tax that's put on based on sufficiency. Okay, jerks, we know that we can build a computer with 32 kilograms of carbon. Where are you? Why are you so bad? Why can't you do this? Right now, nobody looks at that kind of stuff.
What the people say, and if I can't make it through tomorrow, I better make it through today.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Lloyd Alter. He's an environmental journalist, and his Substack is Carbon Upfront. It's lloydalter.substack.com. So, Lloyd, we were talking about Apple. I couldn't help but think of a discussion that we had a few years ago when you mentioned the new iPhone being reviewed by the New York Times, and they said, yes, the iPhone 12 or 13, whatever it was, it's very good and the camera's better than the previous one, but we can't in good conscience recommend you go out and upgrade because the other ones were sufficient and they're good phones. And until it breaks and it's out of commission, you should stick with your current phone. I thought that was kind of a turning of the tides in that sense.
And you're absolutely right. That is a big part of sufficiency, which is to make it last, to decide what is enough. And you want to support companies that make it easy to make it last.
I remember my brother telling me when we were little kids, and he's an architect and very interested in design and a Sea Change Radio listener, so hopefully he's listening to this anecdote. But I remember him telling me that companies had the ability to make light bulbs that lasted forever or a lot longer than they do, but they intentionally didn't make them last so that they would always be able to have a market for people buying new light bulbs. That basic tenet is one of the conundrums of capitalism that we're facing right now.
Absolutely. There was a consortium, I think it was called the Phoenix Consortium, where all the light bulb companies got together in the 1930s, and they all agreed that they would design their light bulbs to last 1,000 hours.
Really?
Because, yes.
So he was right.
He was absolutely right. And they got together and they did this because 1,000 hours, they thought if somebody made a light bulb that lasts twice as long, they'd corner the market. And they all knew how to make the light bulbs last twice as long. And so they agreed on this. And then LEDs came along, and an LED will last almost infinitely. The problem with the LEDs isn't the light-emitting diode part, it's the transformers and the rectifiers and the base that always blow out. When we have our LEDs blow out, which they do, it's never the light bulb, it's always the stupid electronics in the base, because we're trying to get modern DC technology going into an alternating current base designed by Thomas Edison in 1902, which is totally ridiculous, but that's what we do. So there's no reason that light bulbs today can't be considered to last forever. And that's an absolutely wonderful thing. But people will still change them because things get better. There's three kinds of obsolescence. There's obsolescence by planned obsolescence, where it's designed into the thing. And that's the horrible thing we had with the light bulb. And there's obsolescence that I had a term for that I can't remember right now. I wrote about it in my first book that, you know, what do you do when things just get better? We're living in a world where an iPhone 15 is demonstrably better than the iPhone 11 I replaced it with. The iPhone 11 I had still worked, but I was going on a big important trip and I really wanted the better camera. And I did it for the improved camera in it. And it went against everything that I talked about a few years ago with you, where I said, well, my iPhone 11 is sufficient and it will be sufficient until it dies. And in the end, I decided to break down and get something that was demonstrably better. And this isn't the worst problem that we should face in the world, that things are getting demonstrably better. I don't want anyone to think that sufficiency means you've got to live with crap because you've got to have it last for 20 years. I mean, people still want things that are better than what they've got. What we've got to get away from is doing it because of marketing, because of advertising, because of peer pressure, because of all those reasons. And that's what happens with car advertising. It's what happens with clothing. It's so much of life is driven by the advertising and the marketing. And that's been going on. I highly recommend a wonderful, wonderful book from 1960 by Vance Packard, The Hidden Persuaders, which was all about how the advertising industry works. I mean, everything in it is relevant today. I did a late review of another one of his books, The Waste Makers, how the whole marketing, advertising, and manufacturing industry is designed to encourage us to buy new stuff and throw the old stuff away.
Well, hearing you describe some of the potential draconian measures that we may someday see, you mentioned that if you wanted to build something that's bigger, then you have to pay for that. That could open up the door for the haves and the have-nots and the equity gap widening, where people are willing to pay for that luxury of having a bigger house or a bigger car. And if they have enough money, they can do it. So like the billionaire class would not necessarily be affected by a sufficiency tax, let's say, where they can pay for it. But maybe that tax could be put into other good policy efforts that would help many more people. Is that the basic idea?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I love the way you phrased it, a sufficiency tax. There was recently a report put out by Oxfam that talked about how increasingly how the one, not even the 1% anymore, the 1/10 of 1% put out vast amount of carbon with their yachts and with their planes and with their houses, and that their carbon emissions are insane. And I used to say, we shouldn't get carried away with the very, very rich because there aren't that many of them, and that most of the carbon is coming from the 10%, which includes like all of us. And the 10% are emitting half the carbon, where the 1% are only emitting 15% of the carbon. But then when you look at that 15%, what it's on the jets and on the houses and on that, I say, yes, a sufficiency tax is a great idea. I'm going to start using your term there.
Oh, see, these conversations are productive.
Yes.
I can't remember the stats offhand. Maybe it was you or one of my other guests mentioned the tremendous inefficiencies that our aviation system has in terms of funding smaller municipal airports, which sound like they're for rural America and for less accessible airports so that people and who aren't close to a big metropolis will be able to have a nice airport. It's a huge percentage of our budget goes into maintaining and improving these rural airports. And who uses them mostly? Private jet owners who are using way more per person carbon than any other people on the planet.
Yeah, there's one airport north of New York, Teton, I forget what it's called.
Teterboro?
Yes, Teterboro. That's just one private jet after the other. And I think north of where you are, or is that Los Angeles, John Wayne Airport?
Yeah, that's in Orange County. That's in Southern California.
Yeah. And they're all just private jet, private jet, private jet. And the government, as you say, is paying for all these. And we all are through the taxes we pay every time we get in a plane. There's a whole airline built around private jets that just carries dogs. That there's a whole airline designed so that the dogs of the rich can go to Europe and join them because they can't go on regular airlines. And dog airline. That's how bad our culture has gotten.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to environmental journalist Lloyd Alter. So you had reviewed a book by Paul Brannon called Timber, How Wood Can Help Save the World from Climate Breakdown. We think of wood consumption as a deleterious one in many ways when we look at like wood pellets as using particle board and as a fuel, etc. And
oh yeah, that's awful.
We see virgin forest being cut down for paper usage, etc. But Brannon makes a pretty compelling case for wood having a sustainable future for us.
Yes, and I would agree with that to a point. The point with wood is that, you know, when you're talking about building something, if you're not growing it out of wood, then you're mining it out of concrete and steel. And we're absolutely, in every case, going to be better making it out of wood than we are out of concrete and steel. The problem is you can have, as I like to joke, too much of a wood thing. That basically people think, if wood is good, then using more wood is better because wood sequesters carbon. The carbon is stored in the wood for the life of the building. And so they say this is a good thing. The trees grow, they suck up the carbon, they store it in the wood. When we chop the wood and put it into a building, the tree doesn't get older and fall down and die and rot and release the carbon again in the normal carbon cycle. And this is true to a point. What you get is you get architects saying, well, if a cubic meter, if a ton of wood stores a ton of carbon, then we're doing more good by chopping down more trees and storing more wood. And that's where you get into all of the issues that you were alluding to, which is, no, we don't want to chop down any more trees than we have to. We want to make sure that we chop down our trees and replant them in a sustainable fashion. We have to recognize that when trees get chopped down at, say, 40 years old, they might still have had another 20 years of their leaves absorbing carbon dioxide. And you chop down the tree, you stop that absorption right there. And trees, the little trees, take a long time to grow to replace it. What I come back to in my argument, where I disagree with Paul, is he would say, the more the merrier because it's storing carbon. And I take a sufficiency argument to it. Yes, let's replace steel. But we don't know exactly to this day. You cannot get from anyone a real analysis of how much carbon is actually stored versus how much still comes out of the roots that are left in the ground, how much from the slash, the branches and the leaves that they leave on the ground. How far did it really travel to the mill? You used wood, burning wood chips to kiln dry it, which is putting out carbon. No matter how you cut it, you still want to use as little as possible. And that to me means sufficiency. You have to design the building to use less and less, make the grid smaller, make the buildings shorter and boxier, stop this inane competition that's happening to build the world's tallest wood building, because if the taller it gets, the bigger the columns get. And who needs all these tall buildings anyway? We don't.
I had a question about that. I read that in your piece. And is that competition new in that there's emerging technology that allows for these tall timber skyscrapers, 18-story type buildings to be built? Or is this just human nature of wanting to compete?
No, the technology of mass timber is relatively new. It was just developed in the mid-90s, and it didn't become popular until about, and nobody even knew it existed until about until 20 years ago. And the codes didn't allow it. So that what we have here is a combination of the architects and engineers pushing the envelope and the building codes and the engineers who approve all these things catching up behind. And I think that, you know, that the tallest buildings in the States right now are two apartment buildings in Milwaukee, of all places, where, you know, it's a sea of parking lots. There was no need to build 30-story condos out of mass timber there, especially lousy glass-covered ones. But, you know, some developer said, I want to have the tallest mass timber buildings in North America and the world, and that's where he built them. And it's insane. It shouldn't be done. So I still make this argument. I mean, Paul and other architects will say the more wood we store, the more carbon we store, the better. Paul actually wants to sell carbon credits, saying, look at all the wood I'm storing. I want to sell credits to somebody else to encourage us to build more out of wood. And I say, no, let's fix the buildings we have now. Let's not build anything if we don't absolutely need to build it. And if we do build it with sufficiency in mind. I mean, all of the studies will show that the building that uses the least amount of material and energy is 6 stories high and a rough box. And if you go to Vienna and look at all the new housing that they're building, it's all like that. 6 to 8 stories, little wood boxes. And that's what we should be building instead of building 30-story wood towers. So for me, it all comes back to sufficiency.
Lloyd Alter, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It was a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Manu Dibango and Eric Clapton. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.